Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
You're a loser. Loser.
Is that what failure sounds like in your head? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Well, I was always fascinated by the brain.
I don't know what the hell's about to happen to me. This is going to be crazy.
The first day I start taking care of patients as a doctor.
To reveal, to find the brain systems of romantic love.
You recognize big, round
objects. You know, when you think about it, a connected refrigerator isn't actually a horrible idea. How many times have you
over 25
years existed? I didn't see
that with your thumb.
The time when I'm healthy and I can almost hear the clock and I can feel like time's getting shorter.
On today's show, a look at failure as both a stumbling and building block for humans. We loathe, fear, and avoid failure, and we feel ashamed when it happens. But it's also often a necessary learning experience. That is certainly true in science, so let's start there. Failure is indispensable to the scientific process, and yet, because of all the emotional baggage we attach to failure, some of that spirit of trial and error is being lost. Carolyn Beeler reports on efforts to get it back.
If you want the truth and you want it now, don't become a scientist.
There is this myth that scientific progress is achieved by some sort of a direct march to the truth, but nothing is actually further from the truth than that.
Mario Livio has lived this truth as an astrophysicist.
Progress is achieved through this zigzag path with many false starts, many blind alleys, so that mistakes and failures are at some level part and parcel of the scientific process.
The kind of people who first discover that the Earth actually rotates around the sun and humans are related to apes have to think way outside the box to get there.
Well, guess what? When you think outside the box, you may make a mistake.
In his book, Brilliant Blunders, Livio wrote about a mistake that Linus Pauling made. Pauling was a chemist who was the first to model protein molecules, and he won the 1954 Nobel Prize.
But when he tried to develop a model for the structure of DNA, he came up with a completely wrong model. He had three strands instead of two. His molecule was built inside out, and it virtually disobeyed some basic rules of chemistry, and this was coming from the greatest chemist to have ever lived.
Pauling's DNA model was all wrong, but it turned out his method of testing it with X-rays, that was all right.
Watson and Crick actually adopted precisely the methods and almost the way of thinking that they actually learned from Pauling.
That's the thing about science. It's iterative. Each scientist building on the failures of the one before in that messy zigzag path to the truth. So science works best when results are shared, even so-called negative results that don't confirm the original hypothesis. But increasingly, these negative results are seen as failures and aren't shared in journals or at conferences. British doctor and advocate Ben Goldacre wants to change that in one field. He's asking the pharmaceutical industry to publish each and every one of its clinical trials. He says when they don't, the consequences can be disastrous.
We saw a very vivid illustration of that in the TGN-1412 trial.
The TGN-1412 trial tested a drug for immune disorders in Britain in 2006. When it was first given to humans, all six men who got it nearly died.
They ended up on intensive care. Their fingers and toes fell off. At the time, everybody thought, oh my God, these people have become very unwell. This was completely unforeseeable. But in actual fact, in retrospect, it turned out that somebody else had tried a treatment like that.
Goldacre wrote in his book Bad Pharma that a similar drug had been tested in a patient who also got sick.
But nobody knew about it because the results of these phase one trials, these first-in-human trials, are almost never made publicly available.
Most drug researchers in the U.S. now have to share data in a public registry, but compliance is spotty. This week, Goldacre brought his All Trials campaign to the U.S. to increase reporting and get old trials published, too. In the pharma industry, there are billions of dollars tied to the results of clinical trials. Even though the stakes may be lower in other fields, this positive publishing bias exists to varying degrees across disciplines. Swedish science publisher Emma Granqvist says even if no one's health is at risk, there are other reasons to share inconclusive or negative results.
So the most obvious one is indeed to avoid wasted resources. So you don't want another lab at the other end of the world doing exactly this a week later.
Another is to correct the scientific record.
If something has been published on this topic saying A is true and you repeatedly find that A is not true, it's important to share that.
Data in nearly 9 out of 10 published articles in scientific journals around the world and across disciplines support the original hypothesis. Despite what those odds would suggest, that's not because scientists are insanely good at making educated guesses. They're still guessing wrong a lot of the time. Stanford research bias expert Daniele Finelli says that research just doesn't get published.
One of the biggest sources of publication bias, I believe, is the sheer lack of motivation on behalf of authors for writing up results that, in their own eyes, are not as interesting or exciting.
The scientists themselves feel that partly this is a failure because they've hypothesized something and it turns out not to be what they thought.
Granqvist argues the incentive system in science is out of whack. Many professors have publication quotas, and researchers have to include lists of articles in their grant applications. This all leads to a widely held belief
that funding will come from publishing a lot and from publishing in well-respected journals.
Journals publish very few negative findings.
So, in essence, you know that if you're going to try to get funding for future grants, it's just a waste of time to publish your negative data.
The open data sharing that's good for science may not be good for the careers of individual scientists, and they're beginning to see that as a problem. Open notebook scientists are now logging data in near real time online, so it doesn't have to be published to be shared. Emma Granqvist is launching a new title at the publishing giant Elsevier this fall called New Negatives in Plant Science.
What it wants to do is mainly two things, and the first is to highlight the issue. The other thing that we want to do is really to provide a platform for plant scientists to publish and share their negative results.
Even the National Institutes of Health is getting in the game. Sally Rocky hands out most of the institute's $30 billion in grants. She says it just changed its applicant CV, or bio sketch.
I think we're trying to change the culture and what we've done with the bio sketch here away from that notion of publish or perish.
Rocky says the old version asked applicants to list 15 publications. The new one requires 5 so-called professional accomplishments that can be annotated with anything from an important data set to a new mouse model.
You may want to demonstrate how often your data is downloaded off your website. There could be a lot of different things that allow you to demonstrate that accomplishment, so not just a publication.
Even reformers say changing the culture of science is going to be hard. But if it makes researchers even a little more likely to try something new without worrying too much about publishing the results, they say it'll be worth it. After all, according to Mario Livio, that's just the way science is.
You should also not be afraid to think outside the box, even if that will occasionally come at the cost of a blunder.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
A blunder is one thing, fraud is another, and sometimes the ambition to succeed leads people down the wrong path. Earlier this summer, a federal judge sentenced HIV researcher Don Pugh Hahn to nearly 5 years in prison. His crime? Using forged data in a grant application to the National Institutes of Health. He was working on an HIV vaccine. Most scientific scandals don't garner jail time or, frankly, much attention. But for the past few years, the blog Retraction Watch has been attempting to shed more light on science studies gone wrong. Todd Bookman reports.
The Iowa State case is a very public affair. It's been covered in major newspapers. A United States senator has commented on it. All that buzz stands in contrast to the typical scientific retraction, which can be little more than a sentence stating the paper has been retracted. Allison McCook is editor of Retraction Watch. She says when she or another author reach out to a journal or the offending scientist to get the backstory, the reactions span the spectrum.
Well, it ranges. I mean, in the best case, we contact the journal editor or the author. We try both. And in the best case, they tell us what happened. They tell us what part of the paper is affected, why it's affected, how this affects their conclusions. Because sometimes it's just a figure or one aspect of the methodology that had a problem. And then the rest of the conclusions are fine.
That kind of information is valuable. If you're a scientist and you want to build on someone else's findings, you need to know what's still solid and what's been scrapped. But sometimes McCook says you can't shake anything out of them.
Then the other responses we get are no comment. We had a case in 2011 of an editor who told us it was none of our damn business what the reason why the paper was retracted. So in that case, it's really frustrating because, you know, everyone makes mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. But what's helpful is to explain how and why it happened so people can avoid it in the future.
Since Retraction Watch launched 5 years ago, McCook says there's been a shift toward more detailed explanations and longer retraction notices. At least one publication made a public push for higher ethical standards from its contributors.
We had a great case of a journal that an Indian Journal of Dermatology. And they had taken a really hard line on plagiarism. They'd banned authors in the past for plagiarism. And they published a piece from an author who himself had been a victim of plagiarism and had really come out and saying the community needs to take a really hard line against plagiarism. And he wrote some guidelines on how to spot plagiarism, how to handle it, what it means. And ultimately, that paper was retracted for plagiarism, which was just the most amazing thing. If you made that up, you would have thought it couldn't be real, but it was.
There's something like 2 million academic papers published around the world each year. Only a tiny percent, around 500, wind up getting retracted. Some of those flawed works are courtesy of repeat offenders, for which Retraction Watch keeps a leaderboard. It's like a hall of fame for doctorate-level deception. Right now, the Barry Bonds of retractions is a Japanese anesthesiologist named Fuji.
And he was working on a lot of things. He published a huge amount of papers. And for a very long time, people started thinking his data were just really clean. And in science, life is messy. You don't have clean data. You get a bunch of data and then you show a trend and that's the result, but it's never clean. And so his just looked really pretty.
Another anesthesiologist decided to take a look at that pretty data and do some of his own calculations. His results proved Fuji was massaging the numbers.
So in the end, he had to retract about over 180 papers, which is just this huge amount. I mean, it represents 7% of all retractions over a 30-year period. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling. So he is number one, and he'll stay there for quite a while.
Understandably, there's often a bit of bunker mentality when these types of cases rise to the surface. McCook says no one, in any field, wants to be publicly outed for their mistakes.
Well, I think beyond scientists, they're human beings, and human beings don't like to admit that they're wrong. It's embarrassing. I think sometimes I meet scientists, and when they hear what I do, they're a little afraid because mistakes happen in all sorts of ways. I mean, of course, when you make a really bad mistake, you go to jail and have to pay millions of dollars. But most people, they're just trying to get by, and maybe they're stressed. And they just admitting the mistake, accepting the punishment that's given to you, and helping everyone else learn from it is the best response you can have.
Allison McCook, she is the editor of the blog Retraction Watch. Todd Bookman produced this piece. Coming up, when your slime mold won't cooperate, your expedition is a total bust, and when nobody seems to even understand a word you're saying, how do you deal? Still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse AstraZeneca strives to offer employees a vibrant, stimulating, and collaborative work environment. AstraZeneca aims to foster a culture that puts patients first, promotes scientific curiosity, values the power of diversity, and ultimately attracts, develops, and retains great people. Learn more about career opportunities with AstraZeneca at astrazeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about failure, and so far we've established that failure is not a bad thing per se, especially for scientists. You just have to own it, learn from it, share your failures with the world. But when you're in that moment of failure, when it's your experiment that's just not working out, I'm sure things don't feel all that neat and clear-cut. Alana Gordon asked science students around Drexel University in Philadelphia to describe that experience.
Hi, my name is Robert Carlson. I'm a five-year bio student.
What's the longest experiment you've done?
Longest experiment? Probably 10 weeks, the entire length of the term.
And what did you set out to find out?
We wanted to find out how the slime molds would phototax, which is basically the way they react to light.
So what happened?
It was confusing. I wouldn't say it didn't work entirely. We just didn't see the kind of results that we kind of originally expected to see.
My name is Tanya Del Rivero. I'm studying neuropathic pain. I am growing these cells, these neural stem cells, and I've been trying to culture them. This is my fourth attempt, and it's not supposed to be that difficult, but the problem is there's these spores and like they somehow get into the cell culture dishes, and then you get fungi that start growing. So after like a week or two of growing the cells, I keep finding like fungus and fungus and fungus. And, you know, it's really frustrating when I'm like finally start to get them growing. I'm like, yes, I have these cells. I have full plates. And then the next day I'm like, oh, fungus has come in. I have to start from scratch. I can't even start any experiments yet until I get the cells growing.
I'm Alex Wexler. I'm an undergraduate biology major. I've had experiments fail. I was doing one experiment back in high school, or late middle school into high school, with changing the mineral amount in water and seeing if it affected crayfish growth, and it just wound up not having any effect. So it was like all that work, and I really didn't have any data that correlated to anything. So it was just a waste of time. In retrospect, I learned a lot about crayfish.
Science students outside of Drexel University in Philadelphia talking to Alana Gordon about the quiet pain and frustration of failing experiments. Which brings us to another aspect of failure. Even when we know it's part of the process, that it's a good thing, we still don't like it, and that's putting it mildly. Why is that? I asked Taya Cohen. She teaches organizational behavior and theory at Carnegie Mellon University's Business School in Pittsburgh.
At the root of failure and the fear of failure is shame, which is a very unpleasant emotion associated with feeling like one is a bad person or has a flawed or defective self. Shame can lead people to want to hide from others. So the experience of failure or the anticipation of failure can activate the emotion of shame.
So is it always the thought of what will others think of me now? Is that what makes us so afraid of it?
It can be that thought of what will others think of me. It can also be a person's thoughts about themselves. What kind of person am I? If I make this mistake, if I fail, how does that affect who I am and how I see myself, as well as how others might see me?
Who tends to deal better with failure?
People who tend to focus on their behaviors and what they did, feeling guilty about what they did, as opposed to feeling ashamed of themselves. So when some people make mistakes, they tend to focus more narrowly on their behavior. So I made a mistake, I did a bad thing, and now I'm going to think of ways I can correct for this or repair. In my research, I call this guilt proneness, this anticipation that if you did something wrong, you would feel bad about your behavior. And that's different from what we might think of as shame proneness, where if you do something wrong, you might think, I'm a bad person. And if you think you're a bad person, that's a much harder thought to counteract, and it might lead you to want to withdraw from other people. And so the focus on specific behaviors is a healthier response, because you can often change your behavior, where it's much harder to change your whole self.
It sounds like failure requires some analysis, though, to figure out what was my role in this, what happened, maybe there were some circumstances that I could or could not control.
Right. There has to be some recognition of your own role in the failure, or understanding of why it occurred. The worst response in many cases is when a person doesn't take any personal responsibility, especially in circumstances where they should take personal responsibility. By sometimes people will blame others, they'll externalize, make excuses. And if you don't recognize your own role in what happened, it's hard to then change things in the future.
We do, a lot of us become defensive, though, after failure or when somebody tells us that was a complete bust, what you just did. There is that thing inside of us that wants to say, no, it wasn't, or no, I didn't. Yeah. How does that come into play?
People certainly can get defensive if they feel threatened, and failure is threatening. And often a good strategy in those cases is to step back. It's an emotional situation, often a failure, if someone is telling you that you've done something wrong, and our first reaction is often to lash out. In many cases, after that initial emotional reaction subsides, we can try and be open to understanding why the person is telling us these things. What is there a grain of truth in what they're saying? Can we change what we do in the future so as to avoid that? And that fine line between wanting to protect ourselves and wanting to be receptive to feedback can be a difficult line to walk.
And I guess to analyze a failure, we have to be able to let go of all the baggage that we have attached to whatever has just happened and just look at it as what has just happened.
Right. So either let go or put it in a context and understand that, recognize that, okay, I still can feel these things, but there's opportunities here. So with the failure, maybe brings more different opportunities. And the challenge is in trying to find them and seeing what can you learn next, and how can you move forward after the failure.
It's very hard, though. It sounds good, but
right, exactly. So just understanding that one needs to do these things is certainly no guarantee that it's possible. But people can learn to distinguish their behaviors and evaluations of their behaviors from the evaluations of themselves. And I think that's a good step, is recognizing that just because something has failed, that you have failed, does not mean you're a bad person.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Taya Cohen teaches organizational behavior and theory at Carnegie Mellon University's Business School in Pittsburgh. So please, 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 let me, let me, let me, let me get what I want this time. We're exploring failure today on The Pulse, and now that we've discussed all of the emotional angst that surrounds failing, let's turn our attention to some very special humans who don't give a hoot if they fail. In fact, that's pretty much all they do all day long, and they seem to be undeterred by it. Ten-month-old Henry Bechtel wants nothing more than to put his little hands on my microphone, but he just can't get there, try as he might to stand up. Olivia Saltzman is a year and a half, and she's having a terrible time trying to put colorful rings on wooden stakes. There goes the whole thing, falling on the floor. Olivia and I were also experiencing a pretty serious failure to communicate.
Push, 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 push.
What's that?
Push.
Finally, she holds up a tiny plastic object which belongs to one of her princess dolls.
Push.
Oh, purse.
Push.
And she just doesn't seem to care. That's because at this precious age, from birth to about 18 months, kids only feel the primary emotions.
Joy and sadness and anger and fear and disgust and one other, which is surprise.
Catherine Dalsgaard is a psychologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she says that limited range of emotions means blissful ignorance.
Children are busy, busy, busy in the first year of life, trying to learn how to talk and how to walk and how to use fine and gross motor skills and how to have their movements correspond to what their brain is saying to do. So basically, the first year of life is about learning to walk the walk and talk the talk. So they don't have time or the capacity to know how they are in relation to others and to judge themselves in relation to others, all of those things.
Think about it. How would you learn to crawl, stand, walk, or talk if you were secretly wondering why Hudson over there can already get up the steps even though he was born 2 months after you? Or why little Ella with her perfect hair is already forming three-word sentences? Show off. Dalsgaard says that all of those more complex emotions, envy, jealousy, pride, the baggage perhaps, all that comes later, around 2 years of age.
They are called the social emotions. It means that the child has developed the capacity to understand herself in relation to others.
And once kids understand the concept of achievement and failure on a more complex level, parents play an important role in framing how they deal with setbacks. And Dalsgaard says many overdo it, big time.
Grown-ups are blabbermouths. A child fails and it's, oh, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Don't worry, it's just a mistake. Oh, it's okay if it's not perfect. We can give you a new piece of paper. Look, you can draw it again. And the message that children get from that is, oh my gosh, my failure has made my mother anxious. Look at how much she is trying to correct it or fix it or soothe it. It must be a big deal.
Instead, Dalsgaard encourages parents to allow failure to happen. And if nobody's heard, give your child space to deal with it.
Feeling distress is a normal and important part of growing up.
And being able to deal with that distress and move on, Dalsgaard says that's what's going to count in the long run.
There's a lot of research that says the better you are at regulating your emotions, the ability to soothe yourself, the ability to put the painful event that just happened to you into perspective and then choose how to express your emotions about that is one of the main predictors of adult success.
So dealing with kids' failure is yet another thing parents can fail at. And that's not all. Researchers have also found that how parents praise their children's successes impacts how kids will deal with future challenges. Praising behaviors rather than making glowing blanket statements. So nice work drawing that elephant rather than, oh, wow, you're the best artist ever. That seems to help kids develop a healthy attitude toward learning new skills and potential failure. Here's a thing you could tell your kids. When you deal with failure well and you move on, you just might find yourself on late-night television. That's what happened to paleontologist Ted Daschler, whose discovery of a so-called fishapod landed him an interview with Stephen Colbert.
It looks like this animal specialized in living in shallow water. It's got the fins, it's got the breathing structures, it's still got scales in it, and really is an animal that would do best in water, but may have begun to come on land. And in evolution...
So this is the precursor of all limbed animals?
Correct.
Are you saying I am part trout?
You absolutely... You are part fish.
I am part fish.
A special fish. Kind of fish. A lobe-finned fish.
A lobe-finned fish.
Yes.
So it goes fish, monkey, man.
With a few in-between stages, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
But before Ted Daschler's splashy success, there was a much quieter disappointment that happened way up in the cold, desolate Canadian Arctic. Let's hear his story.
And so our dream in 1999 was to get out there and to find evidence of the earliest limbed animals and the ecosystems in which they lived. I'm Ted Deschler, and I'm a paleontologist at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. I work on fossils, more specifically fossils from the Devonian period, going back 380 million years ago. The area we were looking at had been roughly mapped. Now imagine, though, that you had an area the size of Pennsylvania. Even after we did our homework and realized exactly where the rock of the right age was exposed, how would we know where to go first? We spent 3 to 4 months work just planning for our first expedition up there. Because you have to have everything. Once you're there, there's no corner store to go to. There's nothing. You are hundreds of miles from the nearest anything. And we had spent a lot of money. And we had spent a lot of time. And we had put our reputation on the line. There was a newspaper article back here in Philly. They called it Neil and Ted's Excellent Adventure. We felt pressure to produce. Almost from the first day, we're saying, okay, nothing there. We found things, but nothing of great interest. Our second camp we went up to, we found nothing. Goose egg. Zero. We'd go to the cook tent, have a meal, and go back and read some more, and go to the cook tent and talk or play cards and go back. We were really bored. My colleagues, who had a little more experience and a little wiser than me at the time, said, no, we've got to be persistent. You don't find things way more often than you find things in paleontology. So we get back from that first field season, disappointed, absolutely disappointed. And the frustration was in me was just palpable.
You know, I certainly didn't have that sense that I was part of a project that was really going anywhere real fast. So my name is Fred Mollison. I'm the fossil preparator in vertebrate paleontology here at the Academy of Natural Sciences. And I'm the guy who gets the fossils out of the rock when they come back from the field. I use some compressed air to blow the debris away as I loosen it from the jaw. And it's just a slow process of removing material. You just follow the bone, and when there's no more material to remove from the bone, you're done. You always hope that you have an important discovery, but with paleontology, you get what the earth gives you, you know, so you can't... It's not something you can set your sights on exactly.
We basically had to learn. We wanted to be where the rivers were making big bends and leaving mud on the floodplains, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the key to figuring out what would be the best area to dig. In the year 2000, we went back to the Canadian Arctic, and we were in the regions further to the east of where we had worked before. And geologically, we had high hopes that that would be a better area. And you know what? Almost immediately, I think the clouds opened and the sun shined and we started to find a site which had potential. But again, there was no eureka moment right then and there. The next time we were back was 2002. Okay, one more field season, better rocks, better fossils. But still, we didn't have front page news to report to anybody. So we went back in 2004... and hit a gold mine. What we learned in 1999, when we sort of failed to find interesting material, really started the path. We found an animal that is sort of a stepping stone between the finned animals living in aquatic settings and limbed animals that began to exploit the land. We called it Tiktaalik rosae. That felt great. That was redemption. Felt really good.
Ted Daschler is a paleontologist at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. Tanya English produced this piece. Coming up, taking a harmful ingredient out of a product is a success, right? Don't be so sure. That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about failure today, and our next story is about a hidden failure of sorts. Many shoppers choose certain products not based on what's in them, but rather on what's not. It's got to be BPA-free. It's got to be trans-fat-free, paraben-free. So these chemicals we fear to be harmful have been replaced. But the question is, with what? The product is not always healthier on the other end, and those instances are referred to as regrettable substitutions. Karen Shukurji explains.
These days, if you walk into the supermarket and pick up some microwave popcorn boxes, you'll probably see the words diacetyl-free near the ingredients. Diacetyl is one chemical used to make fake butter. It's added into popcorn at the movies, popcorn in the microwave, baked goods, and just about anything that promises that buttery flavor taste. But there were problems. Ricardo Corona was working in a factory for about 5 months when he started having trouble breathing. Here he is testifying at a public hearing in California about 2 years ago.
When I first went to the doctor, I was told that I had asthma. They gave me some inhaler. After a while, I had a hard time breathing. The asthma medication wasn't working.
Corona is one of many workers who developed a disease called bronchiolitis obliterans after inhaling diacetyl. He lost 80% of his lung capacity and ended up needing a transplant. In one extreme case, a consumer who ate microwave popcorn twice a day for 10 years developed the same disease.
I hope no one else ever needs to go through this.
Some big food companies vowed to stop using it, and they did. But many replaced it with a chemical called 2,3-pentanedione, which is just as bad, according to a report released earlier this month by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. This kind of swap, one hazardous chemical in for another, is called regrettable substitution.
We've discovered recently that a lot of these substitutions that have been made, while functionally equivalent, also have hazards associated with them.
This is Julie Zimmerman, a professor of chemical and environmental engineering at Yale University.
In the pursuit of doing something good, wound up with an unintended consequence of regrettably substituting one chemical for another without eliminating the hazard we were concerned about.
Scientists exposed rats to pentanedione and observed similar breathing problems. Some experts say it's not that much of a surprise. These chemicals are like cousins. They come from the same family, a theme with regrettable substitutions. Laura Vandenberg is a professor of public health at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
You can shop anywhere now and see plastics that are labeled BPA-free, which of course should lead people to ask the next question, which is, what is in there instead if it's BPA-free?
Bad news on that front as well, Vandenberg says. BPS, a chemical very similar in structure to BPA.
I would really hate to think that companies are purposefully putting a poison in place of another poison. You know, chemists have families, they have children, they want good things for their communities. So they're not purposefully making these decisions, but they're making decisions based on chemistry instead of on biology and endocrinology and toxicology.
So why is this happening? David Constable is the head of the Green Chemistry Institute at the American Chemical Society. He says people wrongly assume that there are safe alternatives just waiting around to be used.
The science is not there yet, and that's where we need to do more work to understand and to better design molecules and products so that we can avoid these problems. There's a long road to go.
Green chemists like Constable, who seek sustainable solutions to these issues, have been pushing for more research before making substitutions.
The number of alternative assessments that have actually been done are very small because of the difficulty in the science, but also the difficulty in the politics that attend it.
As for pentanedione and its use in butter flavor, the National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety will release exposure limits by the end of the year, limits that will hopefully prevent workers like Ricardo Corona from getting sick in the future. For The Pulse, I'm Karen Shikarchi.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're exploring the issue of failure on today's show. For Armin Karamanian, failure is not a bad thing. In fact, sometimes it can be rather lucrative. Karamanian is the managing director at Admire Capital, an investment firm located within Philadelphia Science Center. He was a scientist before he got into investing. He has a PhD in bioengineering and brings the skills he learned in the lab to his new field to help him calculate the odds of failure. Armin, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, great. It's great to be here.
What is it you look for in investing? What do you do?
Yeah, so I use the scientific method to make decisions. And in a nutshell, I ran experiments and the laboratory is the stock market. And based on the experiments, I make decisions. So I bet that companies will go up in price and others that will go down in price.
And what do you look for? Like, what predicts that a company will go up or down?
I'd say that's what we work every day on, right?
That's your secret.
Yes.
But tell me something.
You can divide predictive factors in different groups. You can look at fundamentals of the company, but that's known by everybody. Then you can look at what people in the company is doing. For example, if you are the CEO and you're buying shares in the open market or selling shares in the open market, that has a predictive value. But then if I look at the CEO, the chief financial officer, and more people inside the company, that will give me an indication of what's happening with the insiders. And then I also look at what other hedge funds are doing with that company. So one example is there is a factor that we call doubling down. So if a hedge fund has a company in their position and that company goes down in price, they will typically have three options: do nothing, sell it, or buy more. If they buy more, there is a huge predictive value on that information, on that
action. Is that good? That's a good thing?
Yeah, that's good, yeah.
So that means something is up.
Yeah, something's going. It means that they think it went down because of noise, or it went down more than they thought. But then at the end, you got to put everything together. So the fundamentals, what the other hedge funds are doing, what the insiders are doing. And when you combine everything, the sum is greater than the parts.
Do you not really look at the product this company
Correct.
Wants to make?
Yes. We don't look at the company, yeah. We don't look at the product. We look at the accounting ratio. We look at what people is doing. We look at the investors.
That seems crazy.
Yes. Well, I don't think it's crazy. So the idea is we as humans, we have a lot of behavioral biases.
Uh-huh.
And those behavioral biases permeate in everything that we do. So if you think nanotechnology is the next big thing and that's a behavioral bias that you have, like you're anchored in that technology, you will naturally tend to invest in those type of technologies and ignore the rest. Our process allows us to look at all the companies at the same time, and basically each company is competing for our investment dollars.
So failure is just part of what you do?
Yeah, we like to predict failure because we can make money if a company goes up in price or if a company goes down in price. So detecting companies that can go bankrupt, it's a critical aspect of what we do.
So if a startup has a product and they know how to present that product, even if that product doesn't stand a chance of ever working, they might find investors.
Yes. I think that happens all the time. People are funding companies that don't have the potential to create revenue or grow or create a successful business.
And then they just write it off.
Yeah.
So spotting failure is more about knowing that it will happen and when it will happen and using it to your advantage then?
In my case, yes.
Can you give some examples of big failures in terms of investment, not perhaps out of your own? I know you can't talk about things that you do, but in recent history, what were some things that people invested in that went really not well?
Yeah, there is a company that jumps to my mind. It's a company that was doing sapphire glass for the cover of iPhones. So instead of the iPhone has a regular glass at the top, and this is a company that was developing a technology that you cannot scratch it. And the company was very over-levered, so they had a lot of debt. And when the iPhone 6 came and they didn't use the sapphire glass, the company went bankrupt.
You do a lot of analyzing, a lot of scientific work. Do you also go with your gut sometimes?
Yeah, never.
Never?
Never, yeah.
Wow, is that unusual?
I don't think so. I think in my world, either you are somebody who works with your gut or somebody who relies on a systematic process. And the moment you start mixing both, I think that's a potential trouble.
Do you have gut reactions?
I always have gut reactions. I mean, that's why our system works, because what we do is so against the gut reaction.
And then do you track how often your gut is right?
That's a good question. No, I should.
Start doing that.
Yes.
All right. Armin, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Armin Karamanian is managing director at Admire Capital in Philadelphia. Finally on today's show, a look at how life sometimes teaches us to reframe our understanding of failure. Daughter, doctor, and caregiver. Those are three very different roles, but Erin Lockhart had to play them all at the same time when she took care of her mother, who had multiple myeloma. It's a cancer that attacks the bones. Lockhart is currently a geriatric fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, but she's worked in acute care in hospitals before. Caring for her mother, who lived in St. Louis, Lockhart had to not just shift between roles, but she also had to redefine her professional concepts of what success means.
By January, I went to an appointment with her, and at that point, she was down to about 80 pounds from 120. She was having a very hard time getting around. She was in chronic pain and needing really high-dose pain medications. And given that functional decline and her onset of frailty, I felt it was appropriate to start talking about palliative care and hospice. And her physician actually looked at me and corrected me and said that it wasn't called palliative care at their center. It was called supportive care. He then turned to my mom and said, I have a lot more to offer you. You have at least another year. And I had actually had a conversation with her the night before, and I had told her I felt we would be lucky if we had 3 to 6 months. So it was hard to have that conflicting information and to be the daughter doing the prognostication. A few days after we initiated hospice, I was able to get out there. And at that point in time, we anticipated that it would be pretty quickly that she declined. And my aunt had been staying with her and helping her with her medicine and getting her on a schedule. And she was actually awake for slightly longer periods during the day. She was a little more lucid. My stepmother, who's sweet, sweet for doing this, took a train over to St. Louis from Kansas City to spend time with me. And I go upstairs to help my mom with going to the bathroom and doing some things. And a couple hours later, I come downstairs and my stepmother's sitting on the couch and she looks very concerned. And she says to me, Erin, I have to let you know I'm not feeling myself right now. I'm not feeling well. And so Dr. Me jumps in and is like, okay, describe your symptoms. Tell me what's going on. And she says, well, I don't know how to describe this, but I feel like I'm myself and I'm outside of myself looking back at myself. And I'm doing a neuro exam. And as I'm doing it, I'm realizing that her speech is very stereotypical for someone who's stoned. So at some point, I turned to her and I said, Marcia, is there any chance you could be stoned? And she was like, well, you know, I was going through and eating some of the cookies from your mother's freezer to see if they were good and if we should keep them. I went upstairs and asked my mom if there was a chance that any of those cookies had marijuana in them, and she just started laughing. Fortunately, my mother passed when I was at her bedside on April 9th. It was just me. I think in a way she wanted it just to be me. She was peaceful. And for me, and over the next few days, I kind of evolved into this peaceful kind of feeling. And I just felt really proud that we took such good care of her. My aunt and I, all of her neighbors, friends, my other family. When people come together in that way and can support a person through such an important phase, it's a beautiful thing. One thing I think that has changed, and this is partly just maturing in the field is when I was a resident and I heard all these tragic stories, somehow I felt shielded from them, like these terrible things won't happen to me and my family, and they do. And for that reason, I think that we really need to teach young physicians how to manage caregiving, how to manage their patients' caregivers in a way that's compassionate and caring and supportive. I think that sometimes physicians almost shy away from families because they're scared of all that complex emotion and, you know, they don't always know what to say. So I feel like if I can share my experiences and use that as a way to teach people and to normalize some of these things, that's what my mom would want me to do.
Erin Lockhart talking about caring for her mother, Mary Walbridge, who died in April of this year. Erin has written an essay about her experience and how she will take what she's learned into her practice as a physician. It's on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Karen Chakurji is our intern, and this week is her last week with us. So thanks, Karen, for everything you've done. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. Did you miss some of the show? Did you fail to listen or fail to listen to any of our previous shows? They are on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us an email. Let us know what you're thinking about. Any ideas or feedback for the show? We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.